Welcome into the Thursday edition of Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. We have an interesting program today, folks. I believe it was Edie Brickell back in the late 80s, early 90s who said, "Shove me into shallow water before I get too deep." I'm giving you virtual floaties, folks, because we are going to get deep into it today. The book is called Origin of the Gods, Kissem Cave, Skinwalkers in Contact with Transdimensional Intelligence. And our guest is Andrew Collins. We're going to get to him in just a moment. I want to remind you folks about the UFO Disclosure Symposium before we get to our program today. Time's running out. May 27th through the 29th, Vernal, Utah is the place. There are four packages up right now that you can take advantage of. One is a VIP package that includes a tour of Blind Frog Ranch, which is a lot of the same activity, folks, as Skinwalker Ranch. That's in the VIP package. It also has a general admission package in there as well. There's a third package in there. And then you have a package that you can view the conference anywhere in the world. You could do it from the comfort of your own home. Keep in mind, 27th through the 29th is also Memorial Day, so you may have plans going on. The reason why we stress this conference so much, folks, is there are going to be four videos of UAP that have not been seen by the general public. So you're going to want to get in on that as well. This conference is going to be newsworthy, folks. Dr. Travis Taylor, Dr. Avi Leb, you've got other experts out there as well in this symposium that are going to weigh in on these four videos and much, much more. They're going to be bringing up all kinds of things, such as some of the technology that's come out and been talked about in some of these news articles you've seen over the past couple of months, and some of the information that's come out from the U.S. government as well. Lots of things going to be rolled out during the symposium. So we encourage you, there's a link at the description of the show at the bottom. Click on that link, costs nothing to look at that link, and just see if you want to take part in the symposium, the UFO Disclosure Symposium. It is May 27th through the 29th in Vernal, Utah. Either show up in person or show up from the comfort of your own home and take a look at the symposium. I'm going to peek in on this thing from the pleasure of my own home, because I got to know what's going on with this disclosure symposium. Let's get to our program, shall we? Origins of the Gods is the name of the book. Kissem Cave, Skinwalkers in Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. I am pleased to have Andrew Collins, one of the authors of this book, with us today. Andrew Collins is a science and history writer who has been investigating the origins of human civilization since 1995. He is the co-discoverer of a massive cave complex beneath the Giza Plateau, now known as Collins's Cave. The author of several books, including Göbekli Tepe, Genesis of the Gods. He lives in Essex, England, and we thank him greatly for joining us from England, as it's quite the span to get from there to here today. Thank you so much, Mr. Collins, for joining us here on Darkness Radio.
That is absolutely my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Let's start out slow and work our way into it, as this book is filled with so much good stuff. I tell you, this is not, if you are a lover of the paranormal, this book has got it all for you. And it ties so many things. And by the way, you wrote this book along with Gregory Little.
And that's correct, yeah. And, yeah, I mean, Greg's been a very good friend of mine since the early 2000s. And we share exactly the same attitude towards the subject. I mean, he himself is the author of a large number of books on the UFO subjects, as well as, you know, Native American mound traditions. I mean, his encyclopedia of Native American mounds is the absolute Bible, basically. You know, if you ever go to any of those sites, it's his book that mm-hmm. you need. You know, we collaborated on a book about the origins of civilization called Denisovan Origins that came out a couple of years ago. And we wanted to just get to the heart of the whole subject, basically, in a new book that we'd collaborate. Now, we both do our own part, so it's like almost like you get two books in one here. But ultimately, we both come to exactly the same conclusions in the book. And that's the fact that amongst the idea that there are, you know, physical aliens, you know, visiting this Earth, which we'll come on to, there is something else going on as well, something that may even be bigger than that, and that is contact with transdimensional intelligences, beings, consciousness, whatever you want to call it. that has probably been affecting human evolution since the very beginning, perhaps as much as 2 million years ago. I know that that's a very bold statement, but the book basically, you know, shows why this is the case and why these intelligences may well be behind a great many of the UFO sightings that we see today, and that they may even represent the true ancient aliens. You know, the fact that we've been visited by flesh and blood aliens is something that's probably not in doubt. I mean, as early as 1963, Carl Sagan, the great cosmologist and astronomer, obviously worked extensively with NASA, he wrote a paper that concluded that we had been visited on numerous occasions in the past by physical aliens. And, you know, he even suggested looking in things like the Sumerian texts for evidence of this. So if Carl Sagan has said this, I have no problem at all with the idea of nuts and bolts, spacecraft, aliens coming here. But I would say that the vast majority of the UFOs that we see, which are simply objects of light, could be something else. They could be constructs of a substance we refer to as plasma. Excuse me. And plasma is the full state of matter beyond solids, beyond gases, beyond liquids. And it's created when gases are superheated and they break up atoms into a state which is basically consisted of electrons that are emitting photons of light and are surrounded by these electromagnetic fields. And they can be quite solid, they can be nebulous, they can be clouds, they can be what appear to be solid objects. They're seen in the day, at night they can be small, they can be large, they can be huge great mists or clouds, or they can be very small balls of light. And the important thing about these is that many UFOs fit this description. And on top of that, I believe that this is something which, if we interact with, we can, have transformative experiences and even enter into rips into space-time. Because the other important thing about plasma is that it has been predicted that we will find that there is an extra dimension of space operating with within plasma environments. I mean, obviously, we operate on three dimensions of space and one of time, you know, and that's the way we perceive the world around us. That's right. The way that we perceive the universe. But if we are dealing with intelligences that are operating within higher dimensional environments, yes, we can see them, but we will not be able to make out exactly what's going on. We'll see something, we'll interpret it. It may even mold itself to reflect what we expect to be taking place or expect, you know, to happen under such circumstances. So in other words, you know, if you believe in alien greys and abductions or whatever, you'll find yourself being taken aboard a UFO at close quarters. If you are a very religious person, you'll find yourself being transported to the kingdom of heaven. And if you're in medieval times, you suddenly find yourself dancing with the fairies, and eating their food and losing a year and a day. I mean, all of this is part of the same phenomena, something that's been with humankind, and I would say not just for thousands of years, but unquestionably, you know, at least 2 million years.
Andrew,
the book tries to explain how this has happened,
okay,
what's going on, and how it's impacted the rise of human civilization.
If I may, can I flesh one of those points out with our audience here, and that is, we do have some people in the audience who are listening at this point who have had real abduction experiences with even grays, who may be listening to this right now and saying, well, how did I get abducted by something that may be plasma or not real? I have real implants, or I have real experiences, or I've come out of this feeling a real experience, a real 3D experience. Yeah. How does that happen, that something that may be happening in a quantum universe feel real?
If, if they have physical implants, which I'm not doubting it, and they have been abducted aboard, nuts and bolts spacecraft with flesh and blood aliens, that's fine. As I said, Carl Sagan said that the Earth would have been visited on many occasions by extraterrestrials. So I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. But that's not what we're specifically dealing with here. We're dealing with a phenomena and intelligence that can quite literally mold itself into whatever it is that you expect to see. And I believe that there is a sympathetic interaction with this phenomena, probably caused through what's known as quantum entanglement, the idea of entangled states of particles, which can be in two places at once, instantaneously, one responding to the other. That, in other words, you know, we can have particles in our brain doing a particular dance, and their counterparts could be somewhere else, perhaps within an object, a plasma phenomena, that's dancing the same dance. And this in itself could create what we know as telepathy. And although a lot of scientists will say, oh, no, you know, entanglement only works on subatomic levels and can't possibly affect the outside world. Well, we know that within the last 5 years, evidence has emerged to show that quantum entanglement does work in the macrocosmic world. In other words, there is every reason to suggest that human brain patterns, which involve neurons, electrons, brain activity relating to electrical phenomena, could very easily be affected by electromagnetic objects or intelligences that we encounter, either at close quarters or in a distance. And I mean, from my own point of view, I came into this a very long time ago, believing that every UFO was a nuts and bolts spacecraft. Okay. I thought that the smaller ones were scout craft. I thought that the larger ones were motherships, and that any tiny objects were drones sent out to spy on humanity. And that's what I believed for many, many years. But after reading pulp paperbacks by the likes of John Keel and Jacques Vallée, and trying to digest what they had to say, and also finding that most UFO sightings, and I investigated hundreds and hundreds of cases on behalf of the British UFO Research Association and the UFO Investigation Network. In fact, eventually I was being sent all over Britain to investigate different cases whenever they came up. And I concluded at the end of it that something was wrong, seriously wrong, with our understanding of the UFO phenomena, because there were so many cases where people would encounter an object and it would seem to either A, respond to them in some way, interact with them, almost communicate with them. And on other occasions, they'd see an object moving along and they'd focus their mind on it and it would just stop and perhaps change course and the rest of it. Well, clearly that doesn't happen if you see a Boeing 747 or whatever crossing the sky.
Right.
Simply through human observation, we cannot interact with, human aerial technology. Mm-hmm. So why should it be the case with these UFOs, these nuts and bolts spacecraft coming from another planet? Clearly there was something deeper going on. And this bugged me for years. And eventually I gave up UFO investigation. I just couldn't make head nor tails of it. There were no obvious answers. There was no disclosure. People had all sorts of contradictory ideas. And I just gave up. And it was then that I read a book that changed everything. And this was Earthlights by Paul Devereux. Now, he's an Earth mysteries researcher. His book came out in the early 1980s. And it changed everything. Basically, what he said was that many UFOs, again, not all, many UFOs are the product of manifestations that are caused through intense geology, whether this be electricity caused by the stresses and strains of the Earth, tectonic plates, fault lines, mingling with minerals such as quartz, tourmaline, metal ores, particularly copper, also iron, and that they create the right environment where you get these releases of these particles called electrons. Mm-hmm. And once they break the surface, they have the ability to congeal, come together, and create these magnetic fields around themselves and release photons of light to create objects, basically. And plasma is something which seems to be the product of this process. This is what it is. This is what they're creating. They create plasma. And plasma is something that's beyond any kind of matter that we normally deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's not solids. It's not gases. It's not liquids. It's something else altogether. And you know, it's an environment which I believe is somewhere that can become intelligent under certain circumstances. This is something that was first realized in the 1960s by a theoretical physicist by the name of David Bowen. He was American. He came over to Britain to work. He did a lot of work with plasma. And he noted that it seemed to come alive under certain circumstances to such a degree that it almost replicated the cells within the body. Hmm. And what he concluded was that it was being inhabited by an intelligence that was coming up from what he described as a deeper level of existence, something that was beyond physical existence. And he referred to it as the implicate order, which is a bit of an odd term, I know, but what he felt was that it existed in some kind of pre-space that was beyond the normal, you know, physical realm that we existed in. Now, this pre-space, which he referred to and his colleague Basil Hiley referred to, would seem to be some kind of non-local medium. And it's the same medium that quantum entanglement works. Quantum entanglement is, as I said, the instantaneous transfer of information, energy between particles or systems of particles across any distance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it can be quite close, but it could also be, you know, one system of particles is here, the other side, the others could be at the other side of the universe.
Right.
And this communication process can still continue. And this opens up all sorts of possibilities about the existence of intelligences that are taking advantage of this knowledge, but also the way that it affects us, both within transformative experiences encountering this phenomena, but also through what we might call psychic communication, you know, shamanism, altered states of consciousness that could allow you to connect with this same type of intelligence. And that's what I think has been going on for the last 2 million years.
Your partner, Gregory Little, has an interesting theory too in the book. And I want to throw this at you a little bit and see what you think about it. And that is, he brings up the Schumann field, the Schumann principle, in that, you know, the Earth had a natural electromagnetic field before technology came along.
Yeah.
Now we've kind of flooded the Earth with electromagnetic fields, with 5G technology. We have electromagnetic fields everywhere. Your cell phone generates mm-hmm. one. Microwaves everywhere. We've got them everywhere with Wi-Fi. We've naturally boosted the electromagnetic field on this planet to an ungodly amount. Do you think we've opened up portals everywhere to the point where we're asking these? I don't want to say creatures, that's a wrong way to put it, but we're asking life to come forward, or we're opening that door in that quantum universe wide open and saying, come on through and say hi.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think is the probably the answer. But I think in urban environments, what we're doing is we're shutting ourselves off from what is naturally there. And what is naturally there? Well, I think that we're dealing with very intense geomagnetic fields at locations that have an intense and equally intense geology, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And it's at such places, and there are countless examples of them around the world, you know, Skinwalker Ranch obviously being a prime one. Mm-hmm. And at these locations is where this phenomena takes place more easily. Okay. Now, if you know, we were going to talk about Skinwalker Ranch, but we might as well use it as an example now.
Okay.
I mean, if, for instance, you know, that was suddenly built on and there were a whole city suddenly rose up in the Uintah Valley to completely cover it all, would the phenomena stop? Well, probably not, mm-hmm. but it would probably lessen dramatically because obviously the amount of what we call human consciousness interaction would so mess up the connection with these natural forces and quite clearly intelligent forces that are associated with it, that you would not be able to see the wood for the trees. And the phenomena would probably die down to the point that it would become more localized, probably connected with certain buildings, certain places, but you wouldn't recognize it as one big portal location like you do today. And I think that's real. And I think that it's the same probably with many cities. Many cities have started off being focused around some kind of sacred place. I mean, Mexico City, for instance, you know, was built by the Aztecs after this this weird omen of this, you know, this eagle and snake, you know, coming together. And they knew that this was a place where they, I mean, quite clearly, this was somewhere special, some sacred location, even before the Aztecs built it. And of course, we have a modern city on the site.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, this is an example of how a sacred place, you know, eventually becomes a city. Obviously, I live quite close to London. Something very similar would have occurred in New York, for instance.
Okay.
You know, this was sacred places to various Native American tribes, Los Angeles, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, we do mess up
mm-hmm.
the landscape when we create urban environments. But in many ways, what we do is to disperse those energies, disperse those portals to the point that we cannot recognize them as one cohesive pattern like we can do at somewhere like Skinwalker Ranch. But as I said, Skinwalker Ranch is just one of many. I mean, there are others, as we've been talking about, just in the area of the Uintah Basin itself. And in the book, I focus mostly on mountains mm-hmm. that are incredibly pokey as vortex sites or portal locations, and how these have impacted the rise of human civilization. And in my own parts of the book, I focus on a place called the Kezem Cave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why there? Well, it was only recently announced that the earliest evidence of shamanism anywhere in the world has been found there. This takes the form of a swan wing bone that has been purposely removed and modified and quite clearly used for cultic practices. And at the end of its life, it was actually placed in a sort of holy of holies within the cave itself. And the important thing is that this was happening 400,000 years ago. And the people that were there in this cave in Israel were also using these weird stone balls, multifaceted stone balls, seemingly to communicate with otherworldly intelligences. And I mean, this is not some mad idea that I've come up with.
Right.
The archaeologists working at the site have come to this conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time that these people were writing the book on shamanism, they were also becoming the smartest people on the planet. They were inventing so many new ideas in innovation and human technology that it is just too coincidental that they were also inventing shamanism at the same time. We have to ask ourselves, is it possible that their communications with other worlds and otherworldly intelligences was permitting them knowledge and what we might call today downloads of information that was inspiring them to come out with new technologies as much as 400,000 years ago? Well, you know, you say, well, yes, okay, well, that's possible. But what's all this got to do with UFOs and aliens? Well, just a short distance away from the Kezem Cave is a mountain called Mount Gerizim. Now, most of your listeners will probably not have heard of that. But if you look in the book of Genesis and other early books of the Hebrew Bible, you'll find that this was the original dwelling place of God. You know, the God that becomes Yahweh that becomes the Christian God. Mm-hmm. And it was said that that God manifested here in the form, in his form, as the Shekinah. And the Shekinah basically means the presence of God, but it is not universally, but often when this is referred to, it means that he's manifesting as light. And obviously we know from the beginning of the book of Genesis that, you know, God says, you know, let there be light. Mm-hmm. And what becomes clear is there's a relationship between the Hebrew God and the manifestation of light. So I started to look into this place called Mount Gerizim, where the people of the Kesem cave were going to actually get their flint to make for their stone tools. I mean, why? I mean, when more local to the cave was other, you know, flint pebbles that would have been, you know, you could have used equally well. Why did they want to go to this particular mountain to get their flint? Well, I looked into this particular mountain, and it has been known for mysterious lights for hundreds of years. Plus, various of the early biblical patriarchs encountered God and created their own, for, you know, the order, like not order, altar there. I mean, like Abraham, for instance, you okay. know, the great founder of the Israelites, arrived in the area, had a vision of God, and built the first altar at the base of Mount Gerizim. Jacob, who was his grandson, came to the same spot and saw the angels going up and down between earth and heaven as he dreamt. And it goes on and on and on. And mm-hmm. this is the first place that the Israelites bring the Ark of the Covenant after their 40 years in the wilderness. And, you know, it's said that God appeared at this point, you know, in his form as the Shekinah. So, you know, you've got God once again manifesting as light on at the base of Mount Gerizim. Well, I mean, I went out there not just to visit the Kesem cave and to speak to the archaeologists involved, but I also visited Mount Gerizim, which is today in the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. Mm-hmm. And I climbed Mount Gerizim, and there's a community of people on the top of it known as the Samaritans. Mm-hmm. And they claim to be the true survivors or descendants of the Israelites, you know. And, yeah, what they say is that this remains the dwelling place of God, and that, you know, all the things I've been telling you about, they say, look, you know, this is evidence that this is the true place, and that Jerusalem is a Johnny-come-lately, basically. You know, it's not even mentioned in the early books of, you know, of the Hebrew Bible. And it wasn't until the Israelites split into two separate factions, that one stayed in the area of Mount Gerizim. The others went off and settled eventually in Jerusalem, where they obviously built the Temple of Solomon, and obviously, you know, hid the Ark of the Covenant and the Holy of Holies there and the rest of it. Well, all of that is late on in the day. The original place of God was Mount Gerizim. So I went to the top of the mountain, and I talked to the highest ranking Samaritan priest I could find. And I said, you know, are these strange lights still seen on the mountain? He said, oh, yeah, seen on a regular basis. I said, how are they interpreted? You know, and in Arabic, I had a translator with me. He said, Malak. And Malak means angels. Hmm. So to them, the appearance of what we would call UFOs on the side of this mountain to this day are interpreted as angels, you know, the God's messengers, you know, coming to bring his word, you know, to the Samaritans. And that was the confirmation I needed that this place was very important. And can we say that the people, the Kesem people of between 400 and 200,000 years ago, locally, were also witnessing the same type of light phenomena and were having what we would call today UFO encounters? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. I mean, there is an intense geology associated with this mountain range, and it's right in the Jordan Valley, which also has these massive tectonic plates and fault lines running through it. And that would have been there 400,000 years ago. So if mysterious lights are being produced today, you can be pretty certain that they were 400,000 years ago, and that the Kezen people were very much aware of that and went to Gerizim to specifically get this particular type of flint to make their stone tools, which they then used as points of contact to communicate with these otherworldly intelligences. And, you know, so the Kezen cave becomes almost like a showcase site that we can say that this type of communication with these intelligences has been going on for at least 400,000 years. But earlier than that, of course, you know, our earliest ancestors were in the African Rift Valley, in places like Kenya and Ethiopia. And this is where we created the earliest stone tools, beautiful stone tools, mm-hmm. particularly something called the Acheulean hand axe, which appears for the first time about 1.75 million years ago. And I mean, these are huge, great hand axes, and they're multifaceted. They look beautiful. They look like jewels.
Okay.
And they just suddenly appear out of nowhere. Hmm. And you think, well, you know, what changed? Because prior to this time, all we were doing is just getting, you know, a rock and just smashing it and, you know, using the sharp point to kill something or dig something out.
Right.
What suddenly changed? What suddenly changed to give us art, precision, beauty? And I think the answer is the fact that the manufacture of these earliest hand axes corresponds to when we invented fire for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And these fires would have taken place in caves, you know, clearly, obviously,
right.
places of refuge, places where people would have stayed, would have lived, they would have done their rituals. And, of course, you know, you'd have burnt wood on them, you'd have burnt plants, you'd have burnt whatever you could.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, those plants would have included psychoactive plants. And, you know, initially, people would have perhaps gone into a bit of an altered state. They wouldn't have really understood what was going on, but that would have made them start thinking deeper
right.
than they had done prior to this time. And eventually, it may have taken hundreds, if not thousands, if not tens of thousands of years, but eventually they would have realized that certain plants created this effect. And they would have started using them specifically to connect with otherworldly intelligences. And of course, by the time we get to the Kezen cave, this is beginning to get refined to the point that we have the earliest forms of shamanism.
Andrew, I'm curious too, when we talk about the Kezen cave, have electromagnetic field readings been done inside the cave? Is the electromagnetic field inside the cave higher than, say, outside of it? Is it something where maybe a portal is opened up and maybe you're receiving intelligence directly from another source?
In all honesty, the answer is, I think, going to be no, because quite clearly the archaeologists are not really looking for that.
Okay.
Certainly not at this point in time. And I think the justification for doing it would probably be a little bit vague, I think.
Okay.
But what I can say is that some very interesting UFO sightings have actually taken place directly in the vicinity of that cave. I mean, I'll be honest, I've not even put them in the book because I wanted to focus on the Gerizim mountain itself,
mm-hmm.
because I thought that might be watering it down. You know, making such association is you know, weakening, I think, your connection. But it's very clear that the same type of intense geology that creates these environments, what we call electron bursts,
mm-hmm.
were from which you get, you know, plasma constructs suddenly manifesting into reality,
right.
Are there in the vicinity of the Kezen cave as well. Or certainly if we are to interpret the appearance of UFOs and UFO lights in the vicinity, as reported. And I mean, at least a couple of them involve videos, which you can actually look up online. So you can actually see the phenomena that's seen in the sky.
Hmm.
I mean, clearly those sightings are not linked with the cave nearby, but right. it's very interesting. It's in the same vicinity. But I think, you know, we have to look at the fact that you've got a community of people who existed, who may well have been connected with this light phenomena, you know, what we call today UFOs. Back then, we don't know how they would have interpreted these intelligences. The chances are they would have connected them with their ancestors. The chances are they would probably also have seen them in terms of some kind of celestial beings, mm-hmm. I would have thought. Mm-hmm. You know, in other words, something that helps them, something that comes down and helps them and is connected with these objects. And they would have probably drawn them towards them. I mean, you know, they would have done rituals. I mean, I've recreated, or not myself, but an artist by the name of Russell Hussein has recreated this image of the first shaman mm-hmm. inside the Kazem Kite mm-hmm. using these weird stone balls with these psychedelic plants and the rest of it. And you know, and these types of rituals would have drawn, I think, the phenomena towards them in exactly the same way that many psychics today can allow the manifestation of mysterious lights, UFOs, into their presence. I mean, there are people that can do this. I've met them myself. And this in itself tells you that we're dealing with an interactive phenomena, not something that's purely nuts and bolts spacecraft or flesh and blood aliens, that it's a much more complicated than that. And from my point of view, I think that we are dealing with intelligences that interact with us through plasma environments, and that they are almost certainly transdimensional in nature.
I tell you what, let's take our break right here. When we come back, we're going to talk about other things of light, including the Ark of the Covenant and how it tied into Andrew's journey over to Israel. And we also are going to talk about Skinwalker, because and how Skinwalker ties into this entire thing. I may also ask Andrew about ley lines and how ley lines tie into this entire thing, too. We're talking about Origins of the Gods. It's the book that Andrew Collins has co-wrote along with Gregory Little. Kesem Cave, Skinwalkers, and Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. When we come back, we'll talk more about Kesem Cave and all the different lights over there on the other side of the world and how it ties to Skinwalker Ranch over here in the United States. We'll do that when we come back on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is Andrew Collins. He is the co-author of Origins of the Gods, Kesem Cave, Skinwalkers, and Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. Before the break, I had teased Andrew that we were going to talk a little bit more about your trip to Israel. And we were talking about the lights, not only of Kesem, well, not just Kesem Cave, but also of the first mountain there where the Samaritans were. You mentioned in the book about the Ark of the Covenant. How does the Ark of the Covenant tie into all of this?
Well, I mean, the Ark, of course, is something that was created with instructions that were given to Moses when he was on the top of Mount Sinai. Now, Mount Sinai is a long way away from Mount Gerizim, but it had a very similar function, and that was that it was a temporary dwelling place of God, you know, the God that becomes Yahweh. And as we know from the story, the Israelites are in the wilderness of Sinai, and they come across this mountain, and they see this light phenomena on the top of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually, you know, reproduce some images of this in the book, you know, just to show how artists have portrayed it. And Moses goes up to the top of the mountain. We all know the story of him getting the Ten Commandments. But, you know, once they're out of the way, he's told by God to create this weird device. And this device, as we know, is made of what's known as shittim wood or acacia root wood. It's covered with gold leaf. It's got a seat on the top with these two angels, cherubim, facing each other, the so-called mercy seat. And he's told to put the tablets in there. Now, bearing in mind that the tablets are actually made from the stone from the top of the mountain, that's quite specifically stated. Mm-hmm. In other words, he's taking away part of the mountain in, you know, once he's created this box, which we know as the Ark of the Covenant. And God says, this is to be my temporary dwelling place. In other words, you can take me from the top of this mountain where I've appeared as light, and I will subsequently appear to you above this box in the form of a radiant fire or light at night, or and a cloud by day. And that's exactly what happens. And obviously, they make this box, they carry it around, and obviously there's all sorts of stories relating to it. But God will manifest as this light. He will manifest as the so-called Shekinah, which is like this radius, this shining form of God immediately above it. Now, you know, what is this box? Why does it do this? And of course, there are no absolute hard and fast answers here, because, you know, we can't dissect it and find out the truth. But what we can say is that the Israelites very clearly believed 100% in this. They believed that this is the way that God could communicate with them whilst they were in the wilderness. And that, you know, that they had to cover it up with this sort of tent-like structure called the tabernacle, mm-hmm. to make sure that the influence of God did not go beyond, you know, this position and start making everybody ill, which is exactly what happened at one point when the so-called Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. They took it away, and all the Philistines started to get ill, so they had to basically give it back, basically, mm-hmm. Because they just didn't want it anymore because it was causing so much problems. But of course, you know, we can begin to see here the same effects as plasma. Plasma has these very powerful electromagnetic fields around it, and they can create everything from nausea to different mental experiences, to, of course, radiation sickness. And this is something that we know is associated with UFOs. I mean, you know, graphic and quite terrible cases where people have actually experienced radiation sickness and radiation burns after encountering this type of phenomena. And I think that this is unquestionably an obvious byproduct of coming into contact with certain types of plasma. So in other words, what the Israelites did was to build this object through the instructions of a manifesting plasma that was talking to Moses. Now, whether this was directly verbal, whether this was information that was going into his head, like a download, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But he created it to the specifications that God gave him. And God said, if you make it exactly the way that I tell you, with exact dimensions, you will continue to communicate with me. So, of course, they have the Ark of the Covenant with them throughout the 40 years they're in the Sinai, the wilderness of Sinai. And eventually they cross over the Jordan River. And the first place that they go to after they cross that river is Mount Gerizim. And that's the first place. And they do this huge, great ritual called the Ceremony of the Curses and the Blessings, mm-hmm. where six of the tribes climb up Mount Gerizim, and six of the other six tribes climb up the mountain that faces towards it, which is called Mount Ebal. And in the middle, which is where this city called in the Bible Shechem was located, is today the archaeological site of Tel Balata, which is in the Palestinian city of Nablus. And you know, they did this huge, great ceremony, basically. And again, I show various examples of this ceremony taking place, where you've got the Ark of the Covenant with this incredible light manifestation coming out of the top of it, which is interpreted in terms of the Shekinah, God's presence in the form of light. And quite clearly, we're dealing with the interaction of plasma intelligences, which I think, as I say, are probably transdimensional in nature. In other words, they use plasma to manifest in this world and to connect with humans. And this is something that was going on at the time of the Israelites, let's say 2000 BC, or, you know, later as far as Moses is concerned, maybe 1300 BC. But just down the road, you've got the Kezem Cave, where all of this similar activity may well have been going on 400,000 years ago. You know, I mean, it's just remarkable stuff, really.
Yeah.
And I mean, why that people have not focused on Mount Gerizim before, I just don't know. Well, I do. And it's the fact that too much attention is put on Jerusalem, mm-hmm. and the holy mountain of Jerusalem, which is Mount Zion, which is a tiny little hill, ultimately. It's not a proper mountain.
Right.
And of course, you know, we are influenced by what we read to do with Jewish and Christian tradition about the, and obviously Islamic tradition about the importance of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, it really is somewhere that was only of importance at a much later date, from the time of David and Solomon onwards, through to the time of the Second Temple, through to the time of Herod the Great, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, the prior to that time, it had it had no importance. It was, Jerusalem was the site of a tribe known as the Jebusites, and it was the tribes of Judah and Benjamin that took over Jerusalem, probably by force, and just made it their own, you know, their own holy city, basically. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the truth of what happened there.
It's also kind of amazing that the meaning of the Ark of the Covenant has actually changed throughout the years, where it's went from being a communication device to just a holder of stone tablets.
Well, I think that what's important is that those tablets were made of stone taken from the top of the mountain. And there was this tradition amongst the Israelites that God inhabited the top of a mountain, you know, and could be seen in the form of lights, or what we'd call UFOs today. Mm-hmm. I think this is really, really significant. And this goes back, of course, before the Israelites and the Canaanites that occupied the same territories prior to that time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are many scholars that have looked into this, and the idea that the gods of the Canaanites, like El and Baal, for instance, occupied the very summits of mountains in that region. So in other words, what the Israelites were doing really is just following the same traditions that had already been there by the Canaanites themselves, about the idea that if you look towards the God, a mountain, and you could see these weird lights on the top of it, oh, that's your God, you know, mm-hmm. showing that he's around, basically.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And the thing is that this, of course, is in what is today the Palestinian territories, you know, Syria, that sort of area. But this is a worldwide phenomenon. As I show in the book, holy mountains where mysterious lights appear that have become sacred places exist everywhere. I mean, obviously, in your country, you know, you've got places like Mount Shasta, mm-hmm. Blanco Peak in the San Luis Valley in Colorado, mm-hmm. Both places I've visited. Also, I talk extensively about Taishan Mountain in China, where I myself witnessed weird lights coming out the top of the mountain when I was there in 2019. And, you know, there are local traditions about what these lights represent. They are like the grace of Buddha or something like that. That's what they're called. That's what they're interpreted. I also talk about Mount Athos in Greece, a holy mountain there, where mysterious lights have been seen for at least 1,000 years. And there they are seen as the light of God, you know, in a more Christian sense.
Right.
And monks, certainly for the last 1,000 years, have actually gone there and lived in caves and hermitages to try and connect with God in his form as light. And I mean, this is quite an extraordinary concept that mysticism is integrally it revolves around the idea of connection and communication with light that's seen of a divine nature. And of course, this is something that we've changed today. Today, if we saw the same thing, oh, it's an alien from another planet. But this stuff has been with us for thousands of years. You know, we have to accept that and say, well, you know, if that's the case and we are interpreting it in our through our own cultural or religious views of reality, then are we not doing that today as well? And that this is something that the phenomena is almost taking advantage of.
You just made a great transition there, Andrew, in that we're going to come a little further west here and talk about a light that may not be so divine in Skinwalker Ranch. There are lights that are seen on a ridge there in Skinwalker that are considered not so benevolent. They are seen as potentially alien. Let's talk a little bit about Skinwalker here and some of the things that are found there at Skinwalker and why we determine them to be alien and not necessarily divine. Why is it that we look at Skinwalker and determine this activity at Skinwalker to be somewhat of a not so nice nature?
Well, I mean, I think that's one interpretation. And, you know, quite clearly stuff has gone on there that could be seen as malevolent in nature. But I mean, I had the opportunity of going there in 2019 as I was writing this book, and I spent a couple of days there, you know, talking with all the guys, you know, hanging out in the evening, or one particular evening, you know, drinking beer, talking, you know, until late at night, going over everything that, that had gone on there. And I mean, firstly, the general impression is that whatever's going on there is not a lot of individual things that just happen to be going on, that it's part of some kind of collective intelligence, something that is is omnipresent, omnipotent, in the sense that it knows who you are, it manifests what when it wants to manifest, and it can manifest in different ways. It can appear as mysterious lights, strange electromagnetic anomalies, cryptids, you know, portals or whatever. I mean, but it's all part of some kind of intelligence that's present there. Now, in the book, I describe this as an egregore. Now, we know the term egregore from the idea of ghosts and poltergeists, that, you know, that you could possibly create a personality in a building and it will take on its own life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, obviously there's been some famous experiments, you know, creating ghosts in this way.
Right.
And in a way, that's correct, because human consciousness interaction is 50% of what goes on at any location, any portal location, any vortex site, whatever, because it's us that plays a major role, our belief in what is actually taking place. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example.
Okay.
If we went to Skinwalker Ranch, we expect that we might see something weird going on. You know, we'd be quite psyched up to that. And if something did occur, we'd say, yeah, there you go. You know, that's why we were here. That's what we expect to see. But if you went into your local Walmart, you know, car park, would you feel the same way? And the answer is clearly no, unless, you know, there was some tradition that in one particular Walmart car park, you know, weird stuff happened on a continued basis. Then, of course, the human consciousness interaction goes up. It's like, I mean, obviously I live in Britain. Mm-hmm. There are certain places which are known for mysterious lights, the area of Avebury, the Big Stone Circle, Alton Barnes, where all of the crop circles appear, you know, other similar sites.
Yeah.
If I went to them, I would skywatch with the belief that there was a very good chance I could see something. But as I said, if I went to some kind of, you know, superstore car park, I wouldn't expect the same. So there is a human consciousness element to all of this. And we, in many ways, are not responsible for its appearance, but we encourage it to actually occur. And I think this is something that, once again, has been there for hundreds of thousands of years, you know, possibly as far back as the Kesem Cave, that these people there, for instance, you know, in what is today Israel, doing these intensive rituals, shamanic rituals, conjuring up these lights, conjuring up these phenomena, is going to stir it up. It's going to, and when it appears, it's going to seem like the gods or whatever they saw them responding to their presence. It's like the Israelites doing their massive great ceremonies at Mount Gerizim. They're conjuring up that human consciousness interaction is crucial. So anyway, coming on to Skinwalker, I mean, I was there and I was able to speak to a lot of people who are working on the ranch who were not the obvious people. They were just workers. They were there for one reason or another. And many of them had accounts of mysterious objects that they'd seen on the ranch. I mean, whether they were high in the sky, they suddenly appeared, whether they were low level, just passing over. I mean, you know, these were just stories that they were relating to me. And they had no reason to make them up. But the one thing that I found more than anything was that these lights seem to be associated with a particular location. And that's what's known as the Northern Mesa. And that clearly, obviously, is on the northern side of the actual ranch. This is where most of the lights would be seen, you know, essentially just going along the length of it. And this is where a lot of weird electromagnetic anomalies have occurred. People go up there with instruments, with their phones. They start going mental, start going weird. And so you start focusing in on this mess. You also find that the Native American peoples there, the Ute and the Navajo, see it in terms of what they refer to as the path of the skinwalker. This is why this name has become connected with the area. The actual path of the skinwalker corresponds with this Northern Mesa, and the Native American peoples there are not allowed to go on there. I mean, for many generations, certainly for as much as 150 years, they have believed that this is, you know, bad stuff, that they shouldn't go there because, you know, it can create, you know, ill omens, sickness, illness, whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, so you start saying, well, what is it about this Northern Mesa that's important? Well, because we now know that there is a pattern where these vortex locations or portal sites are found, you're looking for intense geology. And you would find, you know, you're looking for something like a fault line. And sure enough, on the western end of the Northern Mesa, on US Geological Survey maps, there is a fault line crossing right the way through it. Now, obviously with fault lines, they are only mapped based on the surveys that have been done. I mean, they could very easily continue. And from the position of the one that's certainly recorded, it could easily continue all the way along the length of that mesa.
Okay.
And the stone there is a type of sandstone, and obviously sandstone has very tiny quartz crystals in it, mm-hmm. that the wind whips up and creates into this dust, which gets all in your throat. I mean, everybody has to wear like scarves around that there. Now, this is perfect environment for creating electron bursts and electricity, absolutely perfectly. So this would explain, right from the word go, any electromagnetic anomalies or effects on human bodily systems. But it's also exactly the type of environment to create plasma objects, plasma constructs. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the listener saying, well, yeah, what about all the cryptids, all the rest of it? Well, those plasma objects are themselves portals. They act as gateways or doorways that may well link with parallel worlds that overlay our own and can allow these reality hoppers, if you like, to go from one place to the other whilst that overlaying process takes place. But as soon as that overlay maybe shifts apart through processes which, you know, we can go into, but, you know, it necessitates us going into things like string theory and M theory and brain worlds and the bulk and whatever, but is that these cryptics suddenly no longer remain in our physical reality. In other words, they've gone back to where they come. And this, I firmly believe, is the case, that although they can be physically real whilst they are here, there is like a switch that suddenly takes them away from our physical realm. Mm-hmm. And they cannot return until that overlay recurs again. And it's nothing to do with just looking and seeing some kind of, you know, vertical doorway. I mean, it's really not that. I mean, that's not the way it works. But I do believe that plasma becomes a portal, a doorway, a gateway between other worlds and this world. And it's probably because various theoretical physicists have suggested that it has an extra dimension of space within it, that it allows that step up and step down process from one place to the other, and that it quite literally opens up gateways, literally.
You bring up an interesting point, and that is, I don't know how much of the Skinwalker show you've seen on the History Channel with Dr. Travis Taylor. This season, they tried an experiment where they went up in a helicopter, and they're early in this third season. Yeah. And they were trying to drop down bottles that basically had GPS tracking systems.
Yeah.
And they went up about 10,000 feet. They dropped these bottles, and these bottles were sliding. It was almost like there was a force field over the ranch itself. And it was almost like they were entering into a portal and then being slid over past the zone where they wanted to drop the bottle. And it was being dropped to the side of where they were trying to drop into the zone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got to try everything, haven't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, without going into in detail, I mean, I have been in communication with the people at Skinwalker Ranch about different experiments that can be done there, but not on a single basis on a single day, but monitoring over a prolonged period of time. And this I worked out with a long-term expert in this field, Rodney Hale, mm-hmm. who's been involved with monitoring anomalous energies, whatever, for the last, three or four decades. And, you know, we proposed this, you know, to Brandon Fugel and his team. And I think that they want to do their own thing, you mm-hmm. know, and if the bottles idea of dropping them out of helicopters, whatever it is, works, then great. But I'll be honest, I think that to get proper results from places like this, you need to be monitoring it 24/7 mm-hmm. for a minimum of weeks, basically.
Okay.
And all of these different areas, whether they be electromagnetism, whether it be ultrasound, infrasound, electrostatic fields, all the rest of it, have to be in play all the time so that when you do get phenomena taking place, you can see it in association with those background field tests and the levels of results that you get. That's the only way that we're going to know how all this fits together. I mean, odd single experiments are really not going to tell us that much, in all honesty.
Right. I guess the reason I bring it up, Andrew, is it almost seems like Skinwalker has its own, and follow me if you will on this, it has its own unconscious offensive and defensive systems.
Oh, well, definitely. And this is exactly what the thoughts were of the guys there, that, you know, you're dealing with an intelligence that knows you. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's across the entire area, and that everything is a part of this single entity, basically. I mean, I think one of the terms I refer to it is the host. And I mean, I've heard this exact same term at the British Skinwalker Ranch, which is a place called Bempton up in Yorkshire. Mm-hmm. There's an investigator there that's done various books by the name of Paul Sinclair. I mean, you may know him. And this site, yes, this area has all the same type of phenomena as Skinwalker Ranch. And, you know, I've had various conversations with Paul about this, and he's of exactly the same opinion, that all of the phenomena is part of a single intelligence in that region. He refers to it as the host, and he sees the activity as almost part of a hive mind. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So in other words, it's all interconnected. It's all interlinked, and it plays with you. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be monitoring the area. You know, you can have your cameras running for hours. The minute you take them, you turn them off, the phenomena suddenly appears. You know, you're going back to your car. It's playing with you. It knows exactly what's happening. And that suggests a type of intelligence here that is not simply flesh and blood aliens here. Mm-hmm. It's something else, something bigger, something that's around us all the time. And I think that it is multidimensional. It's at least works within another dimension of space and arguably multiple dimensions. That's why we call these intelligences N-dimensional beings or N beings, you know, and mm-hmm. the N standing for number or the number of dimensions involved. And we don't know how many. It could be 5, it could be 11, it could be 32. We don't know. Right. So we just call them N-dimensional beings, basically.
Your colleague and co-writer in the book, Gregory Little, has a term for it that the Native American communities call it. They call it the trickster.
Well, that's true. Yeah. And it is. And I mean, it could be just called God. It could be called the devil. It could be called anything. All of these are terms that are cultural or religious in nature. Mm-hmm. And quite clearly, the result of this phenomena, you can see as good or bad. I mean, here in Britain, places that are associated with strange lights are generally associated either with the little folk, you know, the elves, fairies, hobgoblins. And this is often reflected in folklore and place names where it takes place, you know, or it's quite clearly becomes a sacred site, a place sacred to God and the angels, the saints. Mm-hmm. And a church is built on the spot. But that church and that churchyard are still associated with strange light phenomena. And often you'll find that these locations have the same saint, for instance, a saint that's connected with light manifestations, mm-hmm. Like St. John the Baptist, for instance. On Midsummer's Eve, fires are lit, or certainly were in the past, all over Britain. So you'd have all these like hilltops where these fires would burn. Well, earlier books that I've done, I show that the reason why these places became sacred and became associated with St. John the Baptist was often because mysterious lights were seen there, and that they were seen as the manifestation of these saints before that attribution became attached to that site. So, you know, in other words, you could either go down one path and see it all connected with the devil and fairies and elves, or you could take it down the more divine, sacred path and connect it with angels, God, and the saints. But it's all the same, ultimately. But it's a human interaction, human consciousness interaction, that's key. Because if you took us out of the picture and you just had these sites and you just monitor them, I mean, let's say you took all humans off the earth, mm-hmm. would this phenomena still occur? And the answer to that, I think, is yes, but not on the same level at all.
I believe
you know, I mean,
right. Yeah.
There are pictures that are emerging from Mars, for instance, of these flames or bursts of light on it, which are very clearly plasma. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, all right, you know, NASA deny it. They say, oh, it's, you know, just something wrong with the lens or whatever, your usual sort of story that we get from them. But no, I mean, there is at least two, possibly three separate photos that have been taken of the Mars surface that clearly show strange light objects of light. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I think that this sort of phenomena goes on probably on every planet, I should think. But what's special, what's important is our interaction with it. We mold it. We allow it to manifest in its glory. But we also put our own beliefs and ideas on it. We see it as good or bad. If we see it as bad, it's going to be bad. Mm-hmm. If we see it as good, it probably will be good. And I think that the same thing is going on at Skinwalker Ranch. There's a lot of negativity relating to the phenomena there. And I think that probably doesn't help. That's going to probably generate even more negative activity. It's the same as inside a poltergeist house. Think of Skinwalker Ranch as a very big poltergeist house, basically.
Yeah. Yep.
Because the intelligence that will occupy a haunted house is just like a small version of the intelligence that's influencing Skinwalker Ranch or places, let's say, like Mount Gerizim in Israel. It's the same thing. It's the same type of intelligence, and it interacts with us, and somehow within it are intelligences that are utilizing this opportunity to connect with human consciousness. And if we use it right, it will give us downloads of information on technology, innovation, ideas, et cetera, et cetera. But if we want to see it as some big evil thing, we'll get nothing out of it.
So let me ask you this, Andrew. Are we too far gone on Skinwalker? Can we nurture Skinwalker back to a neutral state? Is the crew that's there now, can they take a different attitude towards it? Maybe take it from a place of... I don't want to say evil, but a place of malevolence, and turn it to something where it could be more agreeable?
I mean, I can only say I hope so. I mean, I'm not going to say anything bad about what's going on there. I would just like to see the monitoring 24/7 over a much longer period of time, mm-hmm. on every different frequency, on multiple levels. That is important. That's the only way we're going to understand how that phenomena can manifest, and to give us an idea of how it will can manifest in the future. I mean, it's, for instance, it's like earthquakes. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a pretty good idea when earthquakes are going to take place now, because the monitoring equipment will go up and down in relation to that. So it will give us early warning. Well, the same thing could be going on at places like Skinwalker Ranch, where we could see that there are changes in the results that are coming through that will say, right, well, clearly something's about to happen. And with human consciousness interaction, we can prepare for it and, I think, get a better relationship. And I think that the other key thing is you have to... accept and acknowledge the presence of the intelligence and work with it. You know, just like a haunted house. I mean, people that bang crosses to the walls in the hope that it will go away are probably only going to make it worse.
Yeah.
But if you come to accept that you have a ghost, the place is haunted, and you work with it. I mean, you know, and not only will the phenomena become more friendly and more beneficial to you, but you yourself will be more relaxed in its presence and you'll accept what's going on. And the same thing, I think, could happen at Skinwalker Ranch. But as I said, we shouldn't just focus on Skinwalker. As we were talking earlier before we went on air, there are other ranches. You were talking about Blind Frog.
Yeah.
But there are other ranches that I know of in that same vicinity that... equally weird phenomena is taking place. I know that. I mean, I found that out when I was there.
Are those ranches kind of a tabula rasa? Are they a blank slate where we could start over, those ranches that are nearby?
You can, but the one that I've got in my mind, which I won't name, the owners want to just not really publicize it at all, but the phenomena is taking place quite heavily. So, you know, in other words, it all comes down to the to ownership, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously with Skinwalker, there's a TV show taking place, but it's more like a reality show, isn't it, in some respects?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, how much scientific evidence will come out of that, I don't know. I mean, as I said, you know, I've been in communication with all of the main players involved and obviously spent time over there. And I would like to see them. That's all I would say. I would like to see them doing monitoring over a much longer period. I think more results would come that way.
Okay. Folks, the book is out there right now. You can get a copy by clicking on the link in the description of this program. The book is called Origins of the Gods. It is written by Gregory Little and our guest, Andrew Collins. Kasem Cave Skinwalkers in Contact with Transdimensional Intelligences. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us today on Darkness Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And folks, I want to remind you as well, the UFO Disclosure Symposium, there's also a link in the description of this program. Click on it, take a look at it. You've only got a couple of weeks now before the symposium takes place there in Vernal, Utah. Take a look at the packages that are available there for you. Again, you can stream it from home if travel is not in your itinerary. You can check it out from home, and I guarantee you the cost is very, very affordable. Check that out. Costs nothing to look. Check that out if you will. And by the way, pick up a copy of that book. I'm telling you, I took a deep, deep read into Origins of the Gods, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. If you are a paranormal enthusiast, this is going to hit all of your pleasure centers. This is a great book. So check it out if you will. Folks, thank you so much for joining us for a great week of Darkness Radio. We're looking forward to having another great week next week. Take care of yourself and each other. And just remember to take a little extra time out for someone who may be in need this weekend and deal out a little extra humanity to those who are in need. Do that for me, would you? Take care of yourself. We'll see you next week. Have a great week, everybody, or a great weekend. We'll see you next week here on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.